This is an ABC podcast.
First impressions and the demise of the so-called friendly frontier. Hi, it's Kate Evans here from The Bookshelf, RN's weekly fiction review program. And we've gone back into the RN archives to bring you a collection of interviews with some of Australia's most significant authors. And Kim Scott is, without doubt, one of those. He won the Miles Franklin Award for his 1999 novel, Benang, and again for that Dead Man Dance in 2010. And it's this last novel we're going to hear about now. It takes place in the early 19th century, in the area now known as Albany in Western Australia. At that point of exchange, meeting, and perhaps possibility, when white settlers first began colonising the southern coast of WA. Could this be a friendly frontier, as some called it? The story is told through the eyes of a young Noongar man called Bobby Wabalingani. And when Ramona Cavall interviewed Kim Scott for The Book Show in 2010, she began by asking him what made this frontier a friendly one.
I think one of the things was it was a tentative settlement for quite a while. I think the British were just making sure no one else claimed it, I think. And so there was a certain power relationship between them and the Noongar people. And I think the other factor in it was the very inclusiveness and accommodating nature of Noongar people. And possibly that flowed from their belief that the spirit of place could never be conquered, and that seeing that as an impossibility. So they were probably very curious about these new arrivals who were prepared to pay the rent, as it were, and to share their own cultural products with the Noongar people. So I think they're the sort of factors that led to it being a so-called friendly frontier, if that was ever the case, for a relatively short time.
How short a time?
Well, look, I think it depends if you look at individuals or you look at two cultural blocks, really. Possibly as two cultural blocks, it may have been a decade, perhaps a bit longer, perhaps. And then with individuals, it varies. Individual relationships is really what I tried to look at, albeit in a fictional sense.
When you say pay the rent, what do you mean? How did they pay the rent?
There's quite a few published journals from the British there at the time, and they were feeding the Noongar people. They were allowing them to share their shelter. In some cases, they were letting Noongar people or one individual take a gun away. They were letting them use boats and ferrying them around the Albany area by sea. So in all those sort of ways, paying the rent or engaging in reciprocity, I think, is another way of putting it. So there was give and take, and it was, I think that contributed a lot.
So there are journals at the time, but what about the Noongar people that they interacted with, the people, the keeper of the journals? What were the records of them like, given that they were seen through the eyes of the colonisers?
Yeah, well, there's also records in old Noongar songs that have been transcribed, and that was probably more of an inspiration than anything else. I'll just mention a couple of those things first. Looking through Daisy Bates' notes, and it's hard to work out her spelling and everything, but I was looking at some Noongar texts that she collected, and in one of them, in the middle of this Noongar language and this strange orthography, the name King Georgetown really leapt out at me, and that was the name applied to what's now Albany in those very early so-called friendly years. And in that example, it was clear, I think, that Noongar people were using the name of the other, so to speak, for that settlement. There was another example where Daisy Bates has in English, well, it's a Noongar song again, but there's one line in English written as Captain on a Wide Sea. And I realised in that text there's a point of view exercise happening. The Noongar composer is imagining himself and looking through the eyes again of the other. So I think it's probably those two things I found really inspiring, in that Noongar heritage containing and encapsulating aspects of the colonial experience. In some of the journals and the diaries, there was a wonderful example of a Noongar man, Mokari, in 1830, within the first 12 months of colonisation, in a hut, Scottish soldiers around him. His Noongar brother enters the room and Mokari sings out, not some traditional Noongar song, as you may well expect, but he sings out, "Oh, where have you been all the day, Billy boy, Billy boy?" And I found that really inspiring, that little bit of cultural sampling, I think you'd call it, and that readiness to appropriate and accommodate cultural forms or the other, once again. And there's those sort of examples that it's quite hard to find in the journals, but putting the archives and Noongar language together inspired me to try and write in the spirit of those early Noongar rather than to be more overtly polemical, really.
Well, let's have an example of your writing from the book. Give us a little bit of a reading, and this introduces us, doesn't it, to Bobby?
Yeah, this is quite early in the book. So I'll just start reading?
Yeah.
Yep. Laughing and loved, Bobby Wabalung in never learned fear. Not until he was pretty well a grown man did he ever even know it. Sure, he grew up doing the dead man dance, those stiff movements, those jerking limbs, as if he'd learned it from their very own selves. But with him, it was a dance of life, a lively dance for people to do together, each man dancing same as his brothers, except for the one man on his own, leading them. It was a dance from way past the ocean's horizon, and those people give it to our old people. Used to be an elder would be on his own, facing all the others as they stood tight together, shoulder to shoulder, but Bobby changed all that. Still just a young boy when he joined them, he made everyone laugh, but there was something about the way he danced that made them all move back and give him space, so that he ended up like the elder, the only one on his own, the only one standing against everybody else, commanding them. The dance? You paint yourself in red ochre, neck to waist and wrist, and leave your hands all bare. White ochre on your thighs, but keep your calves and feet bare, like boots, see? A big cross of white clay painted on every chest. Each man takes a stick about the size of an emu's leg, and sometimes you wave it about, sometimes carry it on your shoulder as you walk up and down very stiffly. Sometimes hold it away from yourself with your arms outstretched. Everybody doing this together, exact same thing on the exact same beat. Everyone in line. And when you move, stepping a fast and even cadence, one after the other and all men moving the same, you stay just an arm's length apart. Sometimes, even though it's a dance, you just stand dead still while one person out front moves his hand very fast, bends his arm at the elbow until the fingertips quiver beside his face. Then he stops dead still, and everyone facing him does it all the same, but all together. Over and over again, the many copy the one, and people clap. Oh, that is a wild and stirring rhythm. And they whistle. All point their stick into the air, like a rifle, of course. And bang, 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 like the boom, boom, boom of thunder or ocean swell meeting rock, but sharper, and the echoes roll on and on in the silence after. A bang and a boom end the bright, whistling music. The neat, sharp dance stops. First time ever we saw that dance, it was as if dead men had come back to life, and, having lost everything once, were more serious and intent and all of one will. Boom and boom again, coming from the sea.
Kim Scott there reading from That Dead Man Dance. So, Kim, that's exactly what you were describing before. That's an image of the way some Noongar people had seen the British arrive and do what sort of a report to arms or whatever it's called. And they incorporate that into their stories.
Yeah. In Flinders Journal, that's 1801, he talks about performing the drill and how pleased Noongar were to see it, and that one man got on the end of the line and was sort of working out the moves. And then it's Daisy Bates again, the eccentric anthropologist, reports her Noongar informant, so to speak, explaining a dance to her, performing a dance to her. It's well over 100 years later that's clearly based upon that, the Marines performing their military drill. And he also performs a song cycle that's all about, all in Noongar language, but all about shore-based whaling, rowing a boat out from sea to spear a whale and be towed around. And so again, they're the sort of things that inspired me, that a strong tradition taking on aspects and some of the cultural forms of the coloniser in a very confident way and transforming them to their own purposes.
Your Noongar people are really sort of intrigued and curious, aren't they, about these others?
Yeah, very curious and very compassionate and accommodating in all sorts of ways, making allowances and helping them out. And that's really intrigued me for no other reason that's a lovely heritage to build upon, the compassion, the curiosity, the inclusiveness, the risk-taking and the trust in one's own heritage. Sounds very grand, doesn't it? But, yeah, that's what I tried to write about and write with.
There's a lot of swapping of clothes in this novel.
Yeah, that again is based upon little instances. So this is a lot of reading resistantly against in the archives, I think. But when you see moments, and there were three, I think, Noongar individuals that asked to get on a ship to come from what's now Albany up to what's now Perth to talk with Noongar people there, which is a really interesting example of liaison, ambassador.
Diplomacy,
sort of work.
Yeah.
And in that encounter, the Noongars from what's called King Georgetown or whatever, when they meet with the Noongar man Yagan in Perth, they swap their kangaroo skin cloaks, Wurrubwuk. And that's an interesting cultural exchange, each in the smell of the other. And so I imagine that happening between coloniser and Noongar as well at different times. And the business of putting on clothing, it seems, in Albany at least, Noongar may well have seen that as part of the ritual for meeting the other, the coloniser. That is, you wash your hands, and there's examples of them washing their hands and going off to clean up and put on the clothes of the coloniser, because that's what you did when you meet these people. And even to the extent one Noongar man is reported as someone gives him clothes that have been neglected and just laying in a heap, and he picks them up, smells them and dismissively throws them back, saying, they're rags, no one would wear those, and they bring him a fresh and better set of clothes. So I think that whole ritual aspect of the encounter and the willingness to engage in that in the interest of better communication was, I thought it was really interesting seeing those sort of moments.
Yeah, reading this book, I thought about the friendliness of a coastal or otherwise being sometimes so dependent on the personalities of the people who meet rather than necessarily the politics of the situation even. Do you know what I mean? I mean, if the first British guy hadn't been a bit open, and if the Bobby character hadn't been open as well, if they had been just two different people, it may not have started like that.
Possibly, Ramona. Yeah, certainly personalities always, and in this story, yeah, personalities are a large part of it. But I think there is, I think it's possible to talk a little bit about how culture informs personality and prioritises certain values or makes certain sorts of behaviour more likely and indeed possible. And it seems to me, of course I'm biased, it seems to me that Noongar culture has, and certainly in these historical encounters you see it very readily, has a great propensity to create or allow individuals like that to be and so confident of who they are and where they are that allows them to make allowances and to accommodate the other in those sort of encounters. It's true also perhaps with in the colonising culture, but I think the individual you talk about there in the novel, Dr. Cross, is something of an exception, and it's possible that the imperatives of the colonising culture are slightly different and probably more about goal setting and achieving those goals and strategic thinking. Perhaps that's what I was half thinking about in writing it anyway.
The time moves back in this novel, backwards and forwards. How did you decide sort of the when and the how to go backwards and forwards in time? Where to start and where to go backwards and where to go forwards to?
Oh, I'd have to leaf through the book now to make sure what it ended up with. I suppose I'm a little bit wary of chronology on its own, especially in these shared history stories, because it seems sort of wrong somehow to be starting with the arrival of the coloniser, because there's a much deeper and longer story. So I want to suggest that all the time. And one of the ways to do it, it seems to me, is through rhythm, really. But also in this particular story, this novel, I started a couple of times, really, with the Noongar character, Bobby Wabulungin, on the ocean or on a ship, and did that intuitively. And when I read it, I thought, oh no, this I can't do this. This is one of the tropes of colonisation, I think, people on ships and empire. But the more I thought about it, the more I liked it and the more I played with it, because it was a way of perhaps of showing the rhythm in Bobby's life. The rhythm of a boat moving on the ocean is part of something he tries to work out. And he has an affinity with the ocean, as Noongar people on the south coast still do have. Those decisions, it's largely intuitive, I must say.
And poetic, and about by the sound of it.
Well, yeah, those things go together, I think. And there was also the other thing I'm trying to work with a little bit in the novel, I think. One of the working titles was Sounding the Whale, I think, which was sort of a pun on the way sounding a whale, that great maritime mammal, just before it reaches the surface and you can see the membrane of the sea about to sort of bubble up as it emerges. And, of course, sounding the whale being some sort of inarticulate cry of anguish, which is sort of in the background a bit in this novel as well, I think, about the damage done since this time of great possibility, about the loss since this great time of possibility I was trying to story about.
There's quite a bit about whaling and Bobby getting on a whaling ship, and I'd written in my notes here elements of an Australian Moby Dick.
Well, yeah, I read Moby Dick. Yeah, while I was doing this, a bit different, I think. Less
whales.
less of a quest. Yeah, and the whales come to you.
Yeah, but there was a, you know, I thought you've read these whaling books very, very closely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and there's some lovely ones to read from when whaling was all the rage in the 19th century. And in the years I'm writing about here, there was French and American whalers along the south coast, and Henry Lawson much later in the 19th century, and this was an inspiration as well, reports meeting a Noongar man in his kangaroo skin cloak, who speaks fluent French, because the Noongar had spent 12 months on a French whaling ship. And I liked that sort of story. Again, that's that confidence and preparedness to take on cultural forms and great skill and ability at doing it. But
talking about skill and ability, though, I'm just thinking again about a scene that you write about of sort of spear throwing and fighting and the choreography of such an attack. And I'm wondering how you did that scene.
Well, I don't know. I just
Are there records of?
There's little bits and pieces, and certainly the last book I did, not the last novel, but the last book I did with Kai Young and me with a Noongar elder, Hazel Brown. She talks of very ritualistic spear fights, having witnessed them. And there's little bits and pieces you can find in the archives. They're through a different sort of lens, I think. But it's not that hard to see that they're very ritual encounters and very sophisticated conflict resolution methods. Mm. And a beautiful way of dealing with violence and conflict in that dancing, dangerous sort of way.
So is this where you've been for 10 years? This is the question. You sound like you've read every archive.
I used to be Kim Scott.
Yeah, you used to be Kim Scott. Read every archive, seen every, you know, followed up every slight mention, really working on this book?
Yeah, a lot of work that informs this book rather than directly goes into it. There's archival work and Noongar language regeneration. I've been working a lot in that sort of area, community workshops and getting little groups of people together, and we make the sounds of our ancestors and of our ancestral place stronger and better, and share them around amongst one another. And that's, I think that informs this book quite a bit. I think that's I've been doing a lot of that, yeah, and a lot of research, consolidating a heritage, I think, and trying to find ways to empower ourselves by sharing it in different sorts of ways. That's what I've been doing for a lot of the 10 years, I think.
Do you think that this Noongar story is the one that you'll return to throughout your life? It's your inspiration, it's your patch, it's your subject?
Probably, not necessarily in literary fiction as such. But yeah, I mean, it's, a lot of my writings to date has been about coming from, where I come from, Weenich Budja, we call it, spirity country, and a hostile sort of history. So it's inevitable, I think, that I return to that and try and work with continuity and keeping that age-old heritage alive and relevant today and into the future. But it's sort of becoming a schizoid sort of literary activity. The literary fiction and the Noongar language stuff are quite different things, and I don't know where I'll go, but it's just so deep and really important to me that where I live and the heritage associated with it and being part of a people that first created human society in this part of the world, that all feels very important. Yeah.
Ramona Cavall in 2010 speaking with Kim Scott for Radio National's Book Show about That Dead Man Dance. I'm Kate Evans, and I do hope you enjoyed this journey into the RN archives. And don't forget, for more review discussions of the latest Australian and international fiction, make sure you follow The Bookshelf on the ABC Listen app.